Einstein equations, right? When they came out, over the last week or so, we've been doing linearized gravity. So I solved the equation assuming linear perturbations, and we got gravitational wave and some stuff. But they do actually have some exact solutions as well. And there are some famous ones. And the first one that I think came out was Schwarzschild solution. So today we will discuss that, and it is very useful, especially in astrophysics, because you can approximate pretty much a lot of things about the stars and planets and things that are spherical with this solution. So what does it say? It's an exact solution. To vacuum Einstein equations, Einstein fields equation, if you want. But when I say Einstein equation, I often mean just the field. Okay. For everyone, E equal to M, what is it, the one that is everybody thinks of Einstein is E squared is m squared plus c squared. I don't even I have never used it or don't use it, but this is the one that when people talk about Einstein, I think of this equation, which are Einstein field equation. So now when I say vacuum, I mean we put the t mu nu on the right-hand side equal to zero, but there is also one more thing. I mean when you have no cosmological constant. So there are also exact solution, lambda is not zero, and they came a bit later, I think, the Sitter, anti-de Sitter spaces. But we will not get to discuss them here in this course, maybe in the cosmology. I think you will see them in the cosmology, definitely. So here, if I assume the right-hand side is zero, then the left-hand side, I have the R mu nu minus the trace. But if you trace it out, then if the right-hand side is zero, then you trace this thing, then it says the trace of this has to be zero. So in general, when you have vacuum and no cosmological constant, then the solution is this, right? The solution should satisfy these equations. Does that make sense? Does anybody remember what was the Einstein equation? G mu nu, what was the formula for G mu nu?
R mu nu minus 1/2 G mu nu.
Right. So when I solve this, and then right-hand side is 8 pi g t mu nu, right?
Yeah.
So if I put right-hand side equal to 0, then it has to, when it's vacuum and no cosmological constant, this has to satisfy this equation. But if I trace it out, I get 1 r here. What is trace of g mu nu? I guess it's g, right? But if I take it up, and do the trace up, so you multiply it, raise this index, so then you get r minus 1/2 r has to be zero, right? I have to multiply it by some g nu mu up. So this is, am I doing it correctly? This gives me the eta mu nu. There may be some other. It's a 4, I think it becomes this. Then anyway, and then out of this you get r equals to 0. Right? Yeah? Santana? Okay, so So all, when I'm in vacuum, no lambda, all I need to look at is this. Okay, now the claim is there is this solution, exact solution of this form, the so-called Schwarzschild solution for the metric that satisfies this equation such that it has this form. Where by d omega, I mean in polar coordinate, d omega squared is d theta squared plus sine theta squared d phi squared. Anything special about this solution? The way I wrote it in polar coordinate.
Spherical symmetry?
Yeah, spherical symmetry. What else?
Time independence of static.
Yeah, none of the g mu nu's depend on time. So how many Killing vector do you think? At least I can read off just by looking at this.
Three,
what are they?
Phi.
That's one, yeah, exactly, because there's no phi dependence here. That's one of them, right? I'm going to call it M vector. Or maybe for now, I just call it C of phi. And then what else? Which other coordinate do they not depend on?
Time.
So that's another killing. So whenever your metric does not depend on a specific coordinate, immediately you can read off the killing vector for that, because then your metric is invariant under the Li derivative of, the, oh, well, you don't do Li, but covariant derivative. This thing, the killing vector equation goes to zero for that. So in this case, and we did it in the class or in the tutorial, right? Whenever it doesn't depend on one of the coordinates, you can read off that as one of the killing vectors. Okay. And whenever you have a killing vector, you have conservations, right? So if I, for example, if I have a geodesic and contract this with a four-vector velocity, that's one conserved quantity. Same thing here. Also in the metric, you can contract it. Well, we don't have T0 mu in this case. But if I did component of T0, the flux of that, I could show they were conserved. Now, I'm claiming take this. Oh, actually, one more. I didn't tell you what F of R is. This particular solution, we call it Schwarzschild, is such that F of R is 1 minus 2 some constant over R, which, as you know already, you're thinking, given that we did the Newtonian gravity, this must represent probably the gravitational, Newtonian gravitational potential of a source of mass M, object M. Okay. So one claim is this is a solution. Put it here. It satisfies it. It's the exact solution. Now I want to make a stronger claim, Birkhoff's theorem. It's kind of like, is it a Gauss theorem in Newtonian gravity? So this says for any, we saw this is a spherically symmetry. Now it says take any spherically symmetric solution of vacuum Einstein equation. So you assume you want to solve this, and your solution is spherically symmetric. Spherically symmetric. I should put the vacuum somewhere. I should have put it here. Solution of vacuum. And it's pretty important. It must be static, right, which we see here. So just assuming this and taking that, obviously satisfying this, you have to, the solution must be, the metric must be static. And the second one, it's going to be asymptotically flat. So when you take R to infinity, you recover Minkowski, which you can see if R goes to infinity, this goes to one. This is already like a flat space-time. This goes to one. This also goes to negative, one with a negative, so it gives you back the Minkowski in polar coordinate, in spherical coordinate. A polar coordinate, right? So asymptotic uniquely described by Schwarzschild solution. I miss a S. Did I put my S over there? Metric. Okay. It's a pretty strong theorem, which is the reason it's good. Is that basically I'm saying if you have some kind of problem situation, when you have an object, there is, if you can take it, this solution into, it has some spherical symmetry, you can go there, SO3. And then you know outside or far away, things are vacuum, you're calculating metric. So this doesn't look less spherical. You find, so even though this is whatever, as long as it is spherically symmetric, I can, and I know then therefore I can find somewhere else where now there is no source, T mu nu is zero. I can find G mu nu at this point using Schwarzschild solution. So if I have a planet or a star, and it's not like doing the non-spherical features are not very important or small, then I can just take the Schwarzschild and calculate it. Okay, so now let's see if we can prove it. Well, let's skip some part of it. Okay, the proof is the first part, which I'm going to skip, is that if you know the spherical solution or problem has a spherical symmetric properties, you can always come up with a metric. And for a spherical symmetric, you can find the coordinate such that it looks like some function times dt, so g0, 0. Let me just write it in this form. I'm some function dt squared. So it's obviously the generic form of the metric will have g0, 0, will have g0, 1, gii, ij, all of them, right? So my claim is, so let's the g0, 0, 1, leave it there. Because it's if I write it in polar coordinate, it will not have theta or phi in it, right? So it will be just, this thing will depend on r and t. The second one, the GRR, call it 1 over f, which also can depend on r and t, but not on the angular direction because it's spherically symmetric. The third one, then you have the r theta components, theta theta components, phi theta, and so on, right? So the ones that are, my claim is you can always find the r coordinates, which, so that part I'm not proving, such that you find the radius coordinate, that the rest of them look as just the sphere area law. And you can go to MTW book, for instance, if why this is correct. You can write it in, so you don't have to put in like g theta phi or thing. Well, it's g theta phi kind of makes sense because that gives you anisotropic terms. G, the rest are not as trivial. You have to work a little bit to show if you have a spherical symmetric, you can get it. But I'm not imposing any other conditions on what is this or this. I'm just saying this. Let's take call G11 this, GRR this, call G00 something in terms of that with the ratio which I define psi to parameterize it. So this can depend on our radius. This can also depend. Does this part make sense? Now, obviously, this is a spherically symmetric. Now, I will define a mass function. So by this, I really mean whatever your GRR is, inverse of it is that. And then whatever your G00 is, divided by G011, right? And then because this is, you can get, then define this. And then last, define, now based on these two, define the mass function as 1 minus, or you can do it, right? 2 half, 1 over half r 1 minus f, which means in terms of f, your f of r and t then is related to mass by the thing that I'm looking for. So once you accept that, that you can write a spherically symmetric metric in this form, but leaving the G0 or this one being arbitrary functions of R and T, then the rest follows easily because now I want this to satisfy Einstein equation. So take this one, you have G0, 0, you have GRR, you have the rest of it, G omega. Put them in R mu nu. Calculate those like Christoffel symbols, R mu nu. And I'm skipping the terms. Then for the zero, zero component, you end up with this equation. Partial M, partial R should be 4 pi R squared minus TT. But I said it's vacuum, so that becomes a zero, zero function, basically putting this as zero. So right-hand side goes to zero. Then you get the RT, one and I leave it as a homework for you to see if you can drive it or not. Or RT, R mu nu. But again, because I'm taking the right-hand side to be zero, this also has to be zero. And last, I think this one is from the trace. You get 4 pi f minus 1 minus tt plus trr, which are also zero. So I get also that. Now, what are the implications of each of these one by one? So one says m does not depend on r. Then the mass function does not depend on t. So that already tells me this thing has to be a constant. So I call it, therefore, m is a constant. Let's call it a big M, capital M. Then from the last one, I get that psi does not depend on t. So therefore, the assumption I made here, it does not partially read with t zero. So psi only depends on r, which means the tt component of the metric now looks like something like this. I have minus the tt component only. Looks like minus e to the only a function of r, the f of r. Sorry, it doesn't depend on r, so it must be a function of t, right? So t dt squared. And I don't have t in the rest of the metric, right? Only here now appears after I set, because if m is a constant, they immediately see f is only on function of r as well. There is no t left here. So this also immediately tells me f is only a function of r. So that's why the rest of the metric, I can put f of r here as I wanted, as Schwarzschild. But I only need to look at why I don't get the psi, because there is no psi is 1 over there. What do you think? Is there a solution here? How do I get back that form? Because everything else, now I arrived at what I was aiming for, except for psi. I'm getting this thing. And what I'm hoping is, rather than this, to get g00 dt squared, to get Schwarzschild, just this thing. Any suggestions? How do I make it look like that? Yes.
Rescale the time, I guess.
Or? Yeah. I can rescale the time, only change the time coordinate by requiring, I want to get rid of this. So this too, if I redefine my time such that the new time coordinate, this becomes, let's say I go from t to a new time, such that dt prime is equal to e to the psi of t dt, which I can totally do, right? It's you just whatever this function is, integrate it over time, and then define it as t prime. So now in the new coordinate, the new time, this thing is replaced by this, right? And this is, I guess, let's put it g prime. The rest of the coordinates I didn't touch. So I call it t prime, but let's now call it t again, because I changed the coordinate. Now the new time, I'm going to call it t, and I get back the Schwarzschild. So therefore, now putting everything together, psi also goes away. So I get that in new time coordinate, ds squared is minus f of r, which is 2 capital plus 1 over that. Plus r squared d omega squared. End of the proof. And as expected, it's a static metric. What was the thing we wanted to prove? A spherically symmetric, consider vacuum solution. It must be static. Yes, it is a static. And uniquely described by this metric. Now, well, I didn't quite show the uniqueness, but I showed that it can be described like that. Now, let's look at some of these properties. Any questions here? Tom? It's good? Maite? Okay. So the properties, main properties you want to always keep in mind. This metric is asymptotically flat again, obviously. You take R to infinity, G0 goes to -1, the other one goes to 1, and so on. Asymptotically flat. And that's basically simply limit of f of r goes to infinity is limit of 1 minus 2 m over r, which is 1. And this is, then therefore you get Minkowski. Now, any issue with this metric? Something that might go wrong? Is it well defined everywhere? No, why not?
R equals to m.
Yeah, it becomes singular, right? G00, the time, G00 direction vanishes the metric, the distance and the distance in R blows up, right? And turns out, and somebody checked the history, I forget again. It took, I think, few decades, maybe I'm mistaken, for people to realize this is not an actual singularity. It's a singular, it's a coordinate singularity. I think by the time that Kruskal wrote the different coordinate system, that it was already like, it took them a few decades. But I might be wrong. To check the Wikipedia again. So F of R is zero at, if R is exactly 2m. Because at that point, G00 goes to zero. And GRR goes to infinity. Now, what kind of situation could I have? Let's say I am describing an object which is spherically symmetric. It has some mass m. Now, I am using my metric to do some analysis, right? Calculate the potential and what other things, or geodesic. And I get too close. Now, if the radius of, if this R plus is less than the radius of the object, then by the time I reach here, I should redo my analysis, because then I'm inside the T mu not equal to zero regime, right? And therefore, I cannot use the solution. So it's okay then. The metric is not applicable because it's not a real solution to the, it's a solution to vacuum, not solution for interior of a star, for example, right? Because it's not vacuum. So then I know I have to use a different metric anyway, because then it's, you're maybe inside, it's not vacuum and so on. So in that case, well, G of Schwarzschild is okay outside. But you go in, then it's not okay. So in this case, R is larger than R plus, which in my units is 2m. The size of the star is much written in the gravitational unit, larger than mass, its radius in terms of mass. Now, but still it's very interesting, right? And I get back to it. The fact that it works, as long as I know it's spherically symmetric, I don't care about the interior. If the spherical symmetry approximation holds, my approximation holds. Now, but then the issue is, what if R is less than R plus? Right? Then in that case, this is the size of the object M, but our my calculate, so this is object as in mass of it is M, but the radius calculated R plus is larger than R, so it's dense enough, much denser than that one, that it reaches this. So, right, again. Now, in this case, as you can guess, what's happening? Anybody? What am I dealing with? You might have heard of it. Something that is extremely dense for its radius. Huh? Tom?
Black hole,
right? So I have a star that has collapsed gravitationally. It was so heavy that when it collapsed, then the radius became much smaller than, or in fact, in that case, the Schwarzschild rift. So whatever happens inside the black hole, I don't know, but it's definitely less than the size of the R, which in that case is Schwarzschild radius. Yes, question?
Yeah, I want to ask, since we care about the spherical symmetry of the vacuum solution, do we care about the if the interior of the massive object we're dealing with is spherically symmetric? Let's say we have, for example, a sphere, but it is an anisotropic inside. It has a weird mass distribution. Does it produce a Schwarzschild symmetric outside?
You have to. So you got to be careful, right? If it doesn't have, and I'm trying to. There are some stronger things to say. What if you average it out or coarse grain it? It's a spherical. But I'm trying to remember how do you average it out, because obviously if it doesn't have a spin or something, then this doesn't work, right? So, but if I average the whole T mu nu over the volume, and I think that if that remains a spherical, I should still be able to use this theorem. So it doesn't need to be interior is exactly spherical, but as long as, but that's a good question. How do I quantify closeness to a spherical symmetric in that average sense? Yeah, that's the question which you have to estimate. But I mean, it's, for example, good estimate if an overall, for example, it's just collapsing or expanding. Now, if you have a small, you can do perturbation, I guess, in that case, and then you have to be careful about how you coarse grain it and you don't. But if you have quadrupole moment, what will happen, as we discussed yesterday?
We have gravitational
wave. So, but that doesn't have a spherical symmetry anymore. So obviously, if you assume it's spherically symmetric, go back to again. The formula we had, right, I said was you had to calculate this. And to calculate that, it was you had to integrate T00, but over Ri, Rj in the object itself. Now, if it's exactly spherically symmetric, and then you go in x direction, then go from plus to minus of the radius, then this whole thing is gonna go to zero, right? So you can, if it was, and I'm doing something like, if, then you go like, this would be y, for example, or, and then z, then you're integrating T00, and if it does not depend on the radius, I think, yeah, you do it. I leave it as a homework to you. You can show that this thing vanishes in that coordinate when you satisfy a spherical symmetry. This integration goes to zero. Assuming this only depends on R and not the direction. Okay, so, we have an issue in this case. It looks like at this point, then my approximation again breaks down, because now, even though I'm in vacuum, once I get here, then the metric blows up, right, where we have it. In G's, this happens and this happened. So again, I cannot, there's a limitation to my metric. This radius is in fact the black hole horizon. And Schwarzschild coordinates do break down at the horizon of the black hole. But the good news is you can calculate all the physical quantities like curvature and the curvature quantity that Ricci's scalar is already zero, but the rest of it, everything is behaving nicely. And then, as I said, Kruskal, Finkelstein, they came up with a change of coordinate to show that, in fact, you can cross this and describe the rest of the space-time, and it's fine. So this metric is okay under the change of coordinates, except when you finally reach at the final point, r equal to 0. So if you have a black hole, now at r equal to 0 again, this will, before I said r equal to 2m, but if you go to r equal to 0, this will blow up. This is, I guess, okay. But again, I shouldn't just rely on this. I should look at my actual scalar quantities that are not coordinate dependent. So I have another singularity at r equal to 0. Now, this one is the one that is problematic, the actual doom of the general relativity, and gets everybody worked up. Because at that point, the curvature blows up. But what kind of curvature? I have to be careful. Not the Ricci tensor, not the Ricci. You have to go to higher terms to see it. So you can calculate the Kretschmann T S, this German name, a scalar. So it's a scalar. It's made out of the Riemann tensor contracted by itself. So it's second order in R in this form. We trust David's notes is 6. Now this is a scalar. It doesn't depend on change of coordinates. If it's blowing up in this coordinate, no change of coordinate can save us. It blows up in other coordinates. So, yeah. Halloween night. what else? Yeah, as I discussed again, for collapsing the stars or expanding things like that, it's a good approach. You can still apply it to some extent. No, as long as they're spherical. And also, if R is much larger than R plus, so then what's happening here? So R plus is 2m. If R is much larger than 2m, can you guess which regime do we enter? We have discussed before. If 2m over R is very small, then obviously if you go to infinity, it reaches Minkowski. But if it's not exactly zero, like in infinity, but it becomes a small, it's a good approximation for Newtonian regime, right? And we discussed it before, right? That's a Newtonian gravitational potential, weak field limit, and you can use it. So even if I have a black hole, but I'm extremely far away from it, then the weak field can work. But if I'm too close to the black hole, then these two are of order one, then obviously it's not a Newtonian limit anymore.
Kazan?
Yes.
Then does Kretschmann scalar describe the curvature of the...
Yeah, so, I mean, we don't have one curvature, right? We have Riemann tensor, but Riemann tensor is a tensor. So if I change coordinate, it changes. So even if you calculate it and it's infinite, it could be that you change the coordinate and looks fine. But usually for assessing the physics, you look for the scalar quantities because then they're observer independent. You change the coordinates, that quantity doesn't change. And in this case, this is an indication that something is going wrong because the first scalar that I know out of curvature is that one, right? R itself, Ricci scalar. But that one is zero, that's okay. It's this one that it's the first indication that things go wrong. There may be higher order ones, let's see. Yes.
So is this somehow analogous to like electric field going up for a point charge to approach it?
I don't know, maybe. Because what goes to infinite there? It's the...
Yeah, like electric field, I guess.
Yeah, but this is even worse than that, I think. Because as we discuss, I know, for example, like I mentioned it in one of the tutorial, you really cannot look at a source, point-like source in Einstein equation, which is what we are doing here. We're saying, well, the size of these objects is much smaller than the scale of mass. But if you take it even to zero, right? Let's see. You want to say, R to zero, that's even worse. And I'm saying even if it's less than that, I'm already seeing the problems. But if it goes to zero, I think that's even worse. I cannot even solve the equations.
I'm just thinking that it could be like problem with this source and not necessarily Einstein equations, and I'm kind of confused about that because in electromagnetism I kind of see there's a problem with idealizing the source, right? Because you said like
a... Yeah, that is definitely a problem. So yes, what I think is an issue that you cannot put a point source tree on the right-hand side of Einstein equation and solve it consistently. That I know. And this is what I mentioned, like there's Gretchen-Grosch theorem that says this doesn't work or you cannot consistently solve it. But we are not even in that idealized case. I'm saying just even if you have a not zero radius, but such that its radius goes smaller than its Schwarzschild radius. Already I know in the zero or at the r equal to zero, things are breaking down. But I mean, yeah, I guess you're right. My analysis is because I haven't even solved things for if that happens, I have to first, yes, I'm saying, well, yeah. In a way you're right because I'm saying, well, you can still come up with solution that go all the way to R almost zero. It won't be Schwarzschild. You have to change the coordinate, but it's okay. You can describe it, except that you fail at the point itself. So, but these are two different problems which I cannot consistently. So there is this issue that I cannot solve, but there is also this other issue that you take and maybe they are the same. That I, in this case, I'm not solving with this Einstein equation over here. I put the source. I'm not even looking at the source. I'm looking at solving the equations outside, which I had an image somewhere, right? I'm always solving it outside of the object where t mu nu is zero. So the only contribution of the source is that it's like a boundary and it has a mass somewhere. But I'm not solving for the source itself. I'm solving only if assuming there is something here, what is metric here? Not in this itself. I don't know if it's clear. I'm saying, well, there are two problems. One is solving this. One is solving this in a spherically symmetric case in And this doesn't even know about this one, but it says it holds as long as you're not at r equal to 0 itself. These are two different problems, I think. And but both of them break down in a way. Okay. Yes.
One more question about the horizon. You mentioned that if we change coordinates, then the horizon can disappear. Then does it mean that?
No, horizon is still there. It has some properties, but there is nothing in the metric that blows up.
Okay.
So I can come up with a different time and a space coordinate. In fact, it's a light coordinate in that case, which can tell you, still describe the space-time metric, geometry, beyond the horizon.
And is that coordinate change the same as changing the observer, or is it?
It is.
It is.
So in fact, I think what we are doing here, we are solving this in as an observer who is flat in the infinity. But when you, if you sit on a shuttle and then go towards the horizon and cross it, nothing bad happens. And this, the solution allows for that observer to go through without any issues.
So there is an observer who doesn't see the horizon, is that right?
Yeah, so in classical general relativity. Now this is a whole other issue if you, and unitarity information paradox that people say, no, in fact, if you're interested, Niyayesh works a lot on this, that if you add the quantum correction, then there may be something happening, drama at the horizon. But at least in classical GR, with the solutions we have, you change the coordinate, you go to an observer that can go through the horizon, and nothing dramatic happens. But if you're interested in knowing about that and then how they made, if you do actually have something going on, then the claim is, and for example, Niyayesh says, you can see some gravitational wave echoes of some ISCO. They come and it kind of reflects something, and then you can look at the gravitational wave signal, extract it, it's tiny. But if we do, that's the signal for quantum gravity or quantum effect at the horizon. So let's see, anything else? Right, and the black hole, just to, even though we hopefully get to discuss them more on Monday, just to give you an idea, they came up here, but we did observe, I think we have now enough evidence that at least one Nobel Prize that was given to it, that astrophysically they are now tested, that they exist. Have you heard of any kind of black holes that have been around PI observed or anything? Have you seen the donut image? there are different kind of black holes that we predict. Some are called primordial black holes, supposedly maybe produced in early universe, tiny, much harder to observe. We haven't seen them yet. Then there are stellar black holes. These are predicted to be formed by collapse of very big stars. They have enough mass, and after they collapse, they form black holes. And this is the one, for example, that we observed in LIGO, whose gravitational waves detection led to 2017 Nobel Prize. Well, it's technically for gravitational wave, but the gravitational wave matched the merger of two stellar black holes. And then we have the supermassive. Supermassive. And they have been making a lot of noise recently too. They measure, there is one in almost most of the galaxies, in the center of galaxies. These are billions of billions more massive than this one. These are, we're talking about 30, 40 solar mass. These are billions of that. Extremely big engines in the middle of the galaxy. And so they first were observed using the orbits of objects close to the center of the galaxies, and that led to the 2020 Nobel Prize, together with Penrose, I think, because Penrose did a lot of work in the theoretical development of the black holes. And then if you walk around perimeter, I bet somewhere you see these donut images, which are orangish, kind of the supposedly image of the black hole. I don't know if I can do a good job. Which are the observation by EHT, Event Horizon Telescope, networks of radio telescope around Earth, which can incredibly do a good job of resolving the image of the shadow of the black hole if light is coming from behind it. So it looks like something black with some arcs that are orangish. And we have two of them, right, I think, by now. And again, a lot of people in this building work on them. Okay, so let me give you 5-minute break, and then afterwards we talk about another prediction of general relativity, two predictions. Things.
So I've got a question. So this starts out on metric.
Uh-huh.
It comes from what? It comes from solving the Einstein equations. But of course I can use I could have used Cartesian coordinates.
Well,
what's the point of choosing this particular set of coordinates?
Right. You're right. Minkowski metric also satisfies the, except that then this one assumes that you might have something that you don't know about spherically in the middle. So it is a most generic class. If you take m equal to 0, you get back the Cartesian solution. It's just that it says, well, this is more generic. That one is one solution. This one is, if m is not 0, because Cartesian solution is like the whole space-time is flat everywhere. So T mu nu, let's say it's a plane. No matter where you go, T mu nu is 0.
Yes.
Now I'm saying, well, you can do more than that. Yes, if you do this, you get the, by Cartesian, you mean Minkowski metric, this one. But you can also handle cases, problems, where you have something spherical and you don't know what's in it, and you want to calculate the solution.
Yeah.
And so this is then the thing to go.
Okay. So, for T mu nu, it's not smooth, right? It's non-zero inside this.
Yeah.
And then it's immediately zero outside.
No, it could be smooth or anything. All I'm saying, well, as long as you know, you enter a regime, like, as long as it's spherically symmetric, it could have an edge, it could just be...
Yeah.
Like this, but it's spherically symmetric. Now, if at some point we reach a regime where T mu nu goes to 0, at that point, any place that Timmy knew is exactly zero, then your metric reaches this form.
Yeah, use that metric.
Yeah, as long as you're far away from the source, then you don't care what happened at the edge of the source, because then you don't have any of the material there anymore.
I guess, yeah. So M here is the mass of the
what? Well, now you have to see, yeah, because I didn't tell you exactly. I defined it to say, and I said, well, it's a constant.
Yeah.
It's a constant that comes out of this integration. It is whatever, it is the constant.
Yeah.
But when you go to the Newtonian limit, it is exactly the Newtonian mass of the object. But in general relativity, I have to be more careful how I define the mass.
Okay.
And there are different definitions. Like one was, I think, was it yesterday I said? Well, you can calculate the volume integration of T00 of an object and call it the total energy. If it's non-relativistic, then it's pretty much just the mass or things like that.
Okay.
But and there are some, even to this day, people work on what is the mass in general relativity. But
so the point is that if I let R, if I let R be big, right, then that is just the
Newtonian, and that mass is exactly the mass you calculate for a Newtonian object. Yeah. Okay. If not, it's a constant there.
Yeah.
How do I connect it to the things I know in Newtonian? That's a tricky one. Okay, so now I gave you some evidence for why general relativity works, but these were not obviously the early evidences that people accepted general relativity. We have been doing it since 1919, so like more than 100 years, right? And why did people believe in GR in the first place, a few years after it was developed by Einstein, Hilbert, and others? The main two evidence come from two effects. One is the perihelion shift, which in fact people knew about it even before general relativity, but they didn't know what the source was. And the second one is because astronomers were measuring orbits of planets forever. The second one is the light bending. Okay. So this calculation is somewhat similar to this. We're going to go through this, a very, at least first, rough calculation of how you can estimate this. This one hopefully will be on the tutorial 8. So you'll do similar thing. But we mentioned that, right, at the very early on, David said, well, we accept if light is traveling in a curved background space-time, it should not go on a straight line anymore. So specifically, if I have a big mass and light, which I guess we see it somehow here as well in this image. The reason this thing is happening is because there's a source behind it, and that the light from that source, which is showing up as an image here, you have to calculate this. But this was a much more interesting, the perihelion of mercury, which is if I have a test particle, bending, the light will also bend. Okay, so, and if I have an image, then when I see the observer sees, they would think that it was somewhere else because the light has bent. But let's focus on this one for now and see if we can estimate this. And this is, for example, for Mercury, which was estimated back then, and we know it for now as well, is about 43 arcseconds per century. But this one was the one that really, because this existed before, so people really didn't believe that maybe it's a coincidence that GR also give you that. But this one was not predicted before. So when it was measured by Eddington, finally convinced everybody that GR is working. Now, there is also some interesting history there, if I remember, because there was, if my memory is vague, there was a mistake, I think, the first time Einstein calculated a factor or so. And therefore, the first time Eddington wanted to plan to go to, fortunately or unfortunately, because of the war, he couldn't go to measure it. But the second time, by then, Einstein corrected the calculation, and then they measured it, and then it was proof that general relativity work is working. But I leave you to do that. Reading by yourself. Now, what does it mean? So in this case, we are talking about if I had Newtonian physics and I had sun or some big star and a small object, test particle, in this case Mercury, would go around it, it'd go on an ellipse, a closed orbit. Now, because of general relativity, that doesn't happen. So it goes, let's say this is the, like this is going there, this is its perihelion here. Now, let's see if I can do it. So it goes, come back, but it doesn't reach the maximum at the same phi that it started. And so on. So the maximum happens somewhere else. And that's the delta phi we want to estimate. Okay. Now, My claim is Sun is almost spherical, Mercury is almost test particle, so I can use Schwarzschild. There is no other planet in this system. So I'm gonna just estimate it using this approximation of Schwarzschild metric. So I have mass of the Sun. Then I'm also gonna take my coordinate, polar coordinate, such that, so if this is the coordinate system, then phi is here, but theta is the, theta equal to pi over 2 is the plane of the orbit. So therefore, I'm gonna fix that to over pi over 2. So then I only need to care about how r changes, how time changes, and obviously how phi changes as Mercury moves around. Okay. Now, going back to the beginning, what did we say about the killing vectors? What killing vectors did I have? There is one for the phi direction. There is one for the time direction. So now I'm gonna call them the one for the time instead of CT. Let's call it kappa. And in this, you can do almost the same thing that I'm doing for the light bending. So things that I'm doing right now, almost everything will hold until I write the geodesic equation. It doesn't matter if it's massive or light. And then at that point, I have to be careful about the trajectory being of the geodesic being time-like or null. But for now, the fact that I define the killing vector to be k doesn't matter. It's just a consequence of Schwarzschild metric. And then I define m vector to be the phi killing vector. Now, if I have a geodesic free-falling object, then I can calculate its four velocity. So, which is each component is given by dx mu by d lambda. Now, if lambda is the affine parameter, or if it's a proper time, we call it tau. If it's affine parameter for null, then it's, let's call it lambda. But regardless, I'm gonna use the notation of, so T by lambda is T dot. Then I have R, R dot. Then theta is not changing because I'm assuming I'm the plane, in the plane of the geodesic and Sun. So theta dot is zero. And then I have phi dot. Quickly as much as I can. We may have to do the rest on Monday. So the conserved quantities, I'm gonna call the first one E. That's the vector K mu contracted with U mu. Which way do I, I'm gonna call it negative of, actually do contraction this way. So therefore, it will be like a, let's see, minus K mu is G zero, mu zero K mu. Let me see, I want K mu, so it's, let's call it alpha, alpha times U mu. Now K only has the t component, so only is in direction of time, so it only has k0, which is 1, so therefore it becomes minus g mu 0 k0, which is 1, u mu, now g mu 0 is only non-zero for g 0 0. So this becomes minus g 0 0 u 0. Now I substitute u 0. And g 0 0 is f in Schwarzschild. So I get minus f, so it becomes f t dot. Now the second conserved quantity for second Killing vector, similar story. I contract M with U mu. So in this case, then you do the same thing as here, except that it's now only non-zero in the 5 direction. So you will only get the G phi phi. And instead of t, you get the phi dot. Because only u phi is, you need a u phi, and u phi is phi dot. But g phi phi is, do I have it here? It's just the d omega squared was sine theta d tie squared plus d phi squared. So g phi phi is just r squared. Right? Does that make sense, Asif?
Not how confused.
Okay. Because I said, remember the portion of the metric that had phi was this. And this was d theta squared plus, sorry, sine theta squared. Plus d phi squared. So therefore, g phi phi is r squared times d phi squared. So this becomes so this is g phi phi. Yes? Tom? Lavoisier? So, okay. So, and then what's the do I have anything else which is conserved? But I can keep my, calculate my, the norm of the u mu itself. Gonna call it kappa. So if I have the affine parameter, for affine parameter, lambda, and if it's time-like, then lambda can be taken to be proper time. So then the normalization of this thing for time-like vector is 1, negative 1. So kappa is 1 in that case. And this is not k kappa. Sorry. So this is 1 for time-like. But if we are doing the other problem, light bending, then in that case, it's a null vector. So then kappa is 0. So, and what is that? So that you, I have to contract u mu by u mu lowercase. So you need to put the g's in. So g 0 0 u 0 times u 0 plus grr times urr, ur times ur plus finally, the last one is g phi phi times u phi, which is phi dot squared. So I just calculated this, but I wrote this as g lower the this. So this becomes all of the terms. Okay, so three, do I have everything? Keep in mind, I want to work with this one so I can reduce this from now on to be 1. And no. Let's see what I can do. Now what I want to do is read off T dot from here. So T dot becomes E is conserved quantity times F. Now, then you can read off phi dot from the second one, which is L over R squared. So that's nice. Now I have the frequency of phi based on this conserved over R squared. And then last one, now I can substitute phi dot and T dot back in here and get an equation for R dot. Which if you do that, you get minus 1 is F E squared over F squared plus R dot squared over F plus R squared L over R squared R4. And then you simplify it. And then finally, you get the Goldring equation, which you are familiar with from Newtonian gravity. You find an equation for R dot in terms of R and the conserved quantities. So there will be, I simplify this, rearrange this, there will be R dot plus some other terms which depend on E, L, and R. And E, you take it to the other side. And I leave this for you to do. Pretty simple algebraic substitution. And if you do that, now this thing acts like your effective potential or changes of the radius in the orbit in terms of the conserved quantity, which is energy. So we have R. Therefore, in this case, where K is 1, becomes if you did a Newtonian gravity and I calculated the orbit of the something going around a massive object, you would have almost the same equations, right? The kinetic problem of effective potential is conserved. Do you know what's different though?
Fourth term is not present. Like
this one. And that makes the makes a huge difference, because naively, if you look at this before, when you draw V of R, V as a function of R. Now let's see, in R going to infinity, they all go to, whether you have this or not, it reaches 1 over half. Now before that, this is the dominant, so it reaches it from below. Now something goes in the middle, which I have to argue depending on the value of L and M, which we might not get to do today. But the at R equal to 0, if you didn't have this term, you were in Newtonian, you were dominated by a positive term, R goes to 0, this would go to plus infinity. So you were dealing with something like this. And probably some minimum here, right? Otherwise, it wouldn't turn up. But in the Einstein gravity, if R goes to infinity, this dominates over that. And that has a negative sign. So I know it's going to be, there's going to be some instability. Because at R equal to 0, the potential goes unbounded from below. Now, the question is, what happens in the middle? Do I get some stable situation where there is a stable orbit? Or do I get no orbit, no stable, or something in the, like an unstable, like maybe bound, but. And this will depend on the ratio of M and L. So what basically you have to do is algebra calculus question, solve for V prime, which is very easy, right? You take the derivative of this. So R squared minus L squared over R cubed plus 3M, no, 12. I take the derivative of this, let me see, no, I guess the 3. I get a negative 3 times this plus 3. M L to 2 times R4. Now you want to know how many extremum the V has. So you have to look for the roots of this function. And if you set it equal to V prime equal to 0, we get, and yeah, I leave it for you. It's, you get a because you can factorize the 1 over squared out, and then you get a quadratic equation if you factor this out for 1 over r, which you can multiply by r squared. You get a quadratic equation, and this is, so you get two roots. Well, possibly, but some of them may be imaginary. Over L squared, which tells you what scenarios you're dealing with. So there's three scenarios, L squared being 12m2. Then in that case, you are dealing with this scenario, V prime. So the two roots become the same. So the two extremum go the same. So you probably have, I have an image. Yeah, something that is going there, but you get an inflection point, but then R being the root here. And in that case, your roots are L, L2 over 2m, which because L2 is 12m squared, you get 6m. And the other two cases, if L2 is, you have less angular momentum, then you have no roots, so no stable. Orbit, so you have, you're dealing with that one, even further, like steep. And if you have finally this case, if it's going faster, orbiting faster, in that case you manage to have two roots because they're both real. So this thing becomes less than one, I get two roots. So now I leave, it's pretty easy to see one of the roots is going to be larger than 6m. It's a bit less obvious to see, and then the other one is going to be less, it's going to be less than 6m. And you have two extremas. Then let's use green. One is a minimum, one is the maximum. So in this case, then so one is at R M, and the other one is at R less than 6M. And it's in fact, if you check the zero, it's gonna be larger than 3m. Or in fact, when you check where it can be, you can, I leave that to you to do. Okay, so let's leave it here. So obviously there will, now I've shown there are gonna be some bound orbits, but we have to fall into this category. And next time we aim for calculating delta phi, delta Brillouin shift. Does that sound good? Any question? No? It's all obvious? Boring? Or too confusing? Nothing. Okay. Yeah. Let's then discuss it, the rest of it, next time.